Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to the September 2015 edition of First Thursday. My name is Will Aitchison, and I'll be your host. This is our monthly podcast where we bring you up to speed on things that have been happening in the area of public safety, labor relations over the course of the last month. And it's, in truth, been a little bit of a slow month compared to some. That's understandable. Courts tend to take summers off too, summer vacations, and so you don't see that many significant opinions coming out in kind of the hot days of August. But we do have a full slate for you, and I want to start with a reminder, and it's a big reminder, and that is that the new Fair Labor Standards Act, FLSA, overtime regulations are going to be with us very quickly. These are the regulations that will expand who is eligible for overtime. The Department of Labor has been in a period where they've been receiving comments on the proposed rules. There were requests, because so many comments were submitted, requests to extend the comment period. And a couple of days ago, the Department of Labor said, no, we've heard enough, and we're going to issue our final regulations. So perhaps even by the time this podcast goes up on our website, those final regulations may be around. And let's talk about them just for a bit so that you know what is going to change. These are regulations concerning who is exempt from overtime under the FLSA. If you're counting, the exemptions are found in Section 213A of the FLSA. And the exemptions are three. They are exemptions for executive, professional, and administrative employees. Now, once upon a time, when the Department of Labor when Congress first set forth these exemptions, it delegated to the Department of Labor virtually unlimited authority to define the exemptions. Congress just simply said that the FLSA's overtime provisions won't apply to executive, administrative, and professional personnel, and gave to the Department of Labor the ability to define what all of those terms meant. Over time, the Department of Labor said, we're going to use a two-part test for each of these exemptions. First, you're going to have to be paid a salary. If you're not paid a salary, and a salary at a certain level, you're not exempt, period. Doesn't matter what your job duties are. Unless you are a salaried employee making X, whatever X might be, you're not exempt. And the second thing the Department of Labor said is if you are salaried, you will be exempt if you have certain job duties. And there are different duties for each of these three exemptions. You can think of executive personnel generally being at the highest ranks in a public safety agency. Administrative personnel might be at the level of assistant chief or perhaps even a captain or something like that. And professional personnel are those typically in jobs where in order to get an entry position in the job, you have to have a degree of higher education, a specific degree of higher education. So the important thing to remember is not those what those duties are. For this discussion, the important thing to remember is we've got these two tests, the salary test and the duties test. And if you're going to be exempt, you have to meet both tests. Now, over time, the Department of Labor has fiddled a great deal with both of those tests. As the cost of living has gone up from time to time, the Department of Labor has raised the salary threshold. And from time to time, the Department of Labor has adjusted what the duties tests are in order to qualify for an exemption. Now, the biggest change happened in 2004. And this happened under the Department of Labor that existed under the administration of the second President Bush. And in that year, the Department of Labor greatly rewrote both the salary and the duties test, mostly the duties test. And what the Department of Labor did was to expand the exemption. more and more people under these new regulations, which were, some thought, cynically called the fair pay regulations, more and more people became ineligible for overtime. And in fact, there's all sorts of estimates out there as to how many people lost the ability to collect overtime when these fair pay regulations were promulgated in 2004. I've seen a lot of guesses that are in the 8 to 12 million people range. And in particular, the salary levels were set almost ridiculously low. And they were set at $23,660 per year, or if you do the math on that, slightly less than $2,000 a month. And as we saw the litigation over the years under these fair pay regulations, we saw some results that really, no matter how you feel about these issues, I think might have you scratching your head a little bit. We saw a decision, for example, from a federal court of appeals, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that a manager in a dollar general store, you know, one of these stores we go in and everything is priced at a dollar. We saw a manager who was making somewhere around $12 an hour, who spent 95% of her time doing what her subordinates did, ringing up sales, pushing a broom, all of that sort of stuff, where we saw a federal court of appeals say that under these fair pay regulations, she was a highly compensated executive who was exempt from overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Well, it's been a not much of a secret at all that when we saw the change of administration from President Bush to President Obama, that the new Department of Labor was going to pay attention to the, in particular, the salary test in the test for the exemption. It's taken them a while to get around to it. You know, we're 6 years into President Obama's presidency, but they have gotten around to it. And here's what the proposed changes were. And actually, I'd be real surprised if the final rules are anything different. The first change is going to be in that salary threshold that you need to be exempt. That is going to move from $23,660 a year. It's going to more than double. It'll become $50,440 a year in 2016. Now, mind you, unless you're at that level, you're not exempt. It doesn't matter what your duties are. So this more than doubling of the salary exemption, of the salary test, is going to just hugely open up overtime to employees who are now not receiving it. Nobody knows the number of people that this is going to impact, but I have not seen an estimate yet that is under 10 million people who will become eligible for overtime. So that's the first of the proposed changes. And last I said, I don't really think you're going to see any of these proposed regulations change in a substantial way. What's the second important area of change? The salary threshold, this $50,440 a year in the future, will be indexed for inflation. So we're not going to have this long period of time between regulations, 11 years since this was last revised, where the salary number will stay static and the value of that salary number will erode to inflation. That won't happen anymore. We will see the salary level indexed. The third thing deals with a kind of an unusual exemption that the Department of Labor created out of whole cloth in the 2004 Fair Pay Act regulations. It's called the Highly Compensated Employee Exemption. And under this exemption, if you made $100,000 a year, it was a lot easier for the employer to say that you were exempt based on the duties test. Remember, you got to earn a certain amount of money and have certain duties in order to be exempt. When you hit that 100,000 threshold, the amount of supervisory or administrative duties you need went down, so that it was easier, much easier, in fact, almost on in every occasion, for the employer to claim that someone making $100,000 a year was exempt from overtime. What's going to change is that threshold, that $100,000 threshold, will go up to $122,148. Where did they pull that number out of? 122, 148? The Department of Labor says that that represents the 90th percentile of worker income based upon federal government studies. And in the future, that number will be obviously indexed for inflation, the same way the usual tests will be. So what this says to employers, and what this says to labor organizations, is if you've had people, without regard to rank doesn't matter in these things, if you've had people who have been claimed to be exempt, you need to review those claims, because depending upon their salary, they may not be exempt by the time you hear my voice on this podcast. Now, the other thing that the Department of Labor did when it released these proposed overtime regulations, it released them in June, is it sent what I think of as a shot across the bow. In Department of Labor parlance, what this is an RFI, request for information, but you'll see why I think it's a shot across the bow. What the Department of Labor said was, look, in addition to what we're doing here, we want people to send us information on whether or not the duties test has been properly applied. So, in other words, we're not just going to look at salary. We're going to look at duties as well. Think about that Dollar General manager who's spending 95% of her day on non-exempt activities, and she nonetheless passes the duties test. I think that's where the Department of Labor is heading on that. The Department of Labor is also saying something very specific. They're saying, and I'm going to quote this now, we understand the importance of concerns about off-duty use of smartphones, laptops, and other electronic devices, and we're going to publish this request for information in the near future about whether or not time spent on these devices is compensable as hours worked. The Department of Labor anticipated they'd issue that by the end of August. I think summer got in the way. It's not out yet, but you can expect to see that shortly. That's going to be a big deal in public safety, because so many public safety employees, police, fire, corrections, so many employees are taking home smartphones and they're working on them. They're sending email, they may be having work-related conversations, and the Department of Labor is saying, we're going to address whether or not that time is compensable. And if the Department of Labor follows through on this, I think you can guess what the DOL's answer is going to be as to whether or not that time spent on these smartphones is compensable. By the way, just for something you should be taking a look at on this issue, there's been a long-running case coming out of the Chicago PD about the off-duty use of smartphones. This is long-running enough that the smartphones in question are BlackBerries. Remember them? And there's been a trial in the case now. It was a week long. I think it was a little longer than a week. Trial to a judge. And we don't have a decision yet from the judge. He's going to go back, no doubt, and write an opinion. But there was a lot of testimony that was introduced about how much time, in particular, investigators and the like in Chicago PD are spending off-duty doing work-related stuff with their phones. In some cases, more than an hour or hours a day. So keep a watch out for that case. It'll no doubt pop up in news stories once we get a decision out of the judge. And of course, we'll be sure to summarize it here. While I'm talking about phones, there was a news story this week coming out of the Cleveland Fire Department about phones. Well, phones and other things, but I want to focus on the phone thing. Apparently, Cleveland Fire Department underwent a big pay scandal a few years ago, and it created, in response to that, an integrity control unit. It's an internal affairs unit. And this unit has done any number of investigations into alleged financial, and put that term broadly, financial misdeeds by Cleveland firefighters. And there were 42 cases that were investigated. Some firefighters ended up getting charged with felonies, and there were lots of questions that were raised. The case that I want to focus on is one firefighter who was suspended for making personal use of his city cell phone. He was apparently using his city cell phone to call women and ask them out on dates and things like that. He was not only suspended, but he was ordered to pay back to the city more than $2,500. This gives rise to one of my little rants. Bear with me, please, but I've just got to repeat the rant. Look, there's really three rules about smartphones. And employers, you need to get these rules through to your employees. And unions, you need to get these rules through to their members. Here are the three rules. Number one, don't use your employer-issued cell phone for any personal purposes. Number two, don't use your personal cell phone for any company, employer, business. In other words, you have a dividing line between these devices, and never the twain shall meet. Rule number three, pay attention to and abide by rules number one and two. No good can come of using a personal cell phone for company business or vice versa. What do you end up with? You end up with a case like this Cleveland firefighter where he's being fined for using his company cell phone to ask women out on dates. You end up with the Chicago Police Department lawsuit where they're using smartphones off-duty for employer-related purposes. And you end up with many, many other things. For example, police officers who are out at the scene of a crime, who are seen using their personal cell phones, have discovered that, in fact, a criminal defendant may subpoena them. They may be brought into internal affairs. And just all sorts of things can go wrong. If you just follow those simple rules and never let the personal and the professional overlap with respect to a cell phone, you're going to have a lot fewer problems than we're seeing out there right now with these devices. While I'm talking about newsy sort of stuff, I wanted to turn to San Jose and the police department in San Jose. Many of you know that the San Jose Police Department has been really decimated over the last few years. It's been the subject of all sorts of political battles. There's been a movement, a conservative movement in San Jose that has resulted in cutbacks to collective bargaining. They bargain under a local ordinance there, cutbacks to pensions. The staffing in the San Jose Police Department is down by hundreds. And not only that, they're unable to fill recruiting classes. And when they fill them, they're finding police officers quickly departing for greener territory. And it's just been a very dreadful situation. And in the last month or two, we have started to see the first glimmer that things may be turning around there. First of all, the Police Officers Association in the city negotiated a new contract. It's not a long one. It's a one-year contract, but at least they're able to negotiate something, and that hasn't been the case in the past. And the second thing that happened that I think is really important is the Police Association and the city agreed, reached an agreement that actually, because it becomes enacted through an ordinance by the city council, actually repeals some of that pension reform, pension cutbacks that existed before. And then the third thing that happened, which is the one I really want to talk to you about the most because it's a very interesting notion. Remember I just said that you had new recruits leaving and taking their training and going to other agencies? The fellow who successfully ran for mayor, his name is Sam Liccardo, one of the bases upon which he ran, and by the way, he ran on, as kind of the darling of this conservative movement in San Jose, one of the planks upon which he ran was that he would insist that the next collective bargaining agreement, or as they call it down there, memorandum of understanding, with the Police Officers Association would have to require officers who left San Jose within a few years of graduating from the academy pay back their training costs. Liccardo, I mean, that was a campaign platform for him. What's happened? This new contract that just was reached between the POA and the city, it doesn't have a repayment of training costs requirement. What occurred? Perhaps it was the education of a new mayor. I'm afraid I'm not quite that optimistic. I think really what's going on is the city realized they couldn't even attract anybody to come to a recruiting class unless they got rid of this repayment of training costs notion. People wouldn't even be signing up to begin with. There's just too many other agencies in the Bay Area, in California, and all over the country that are hurting for police recruits, and police recruits just simply wouldn't put themselves in that sort of environment. Now, the mayor, publicly says, look, we haven't given up on it completely. We're going to have time to negotiate a new contract, and somewhere during my tenure, we'll be able to do it, and we'll come back at it. But you know what? I don't think so. And while I'm on this, let's talk about these repayment of training costs requirements, because you still see them in a lot of different places. In fact, some places they're still enacting them. You see them coming around. What's the legal status of these? Well, I want you to think of two levels of questioning here. The first is, do they violate any constitutional rights that employees hold? Any sort of due process right, or maybe even a freedom of speech right, or anything like that? And the answer the courts tell us is no, they don't violate any constitutional rights of employees. In the absence of anything else, a requirement that a recruit repay training costs does not violate any constitutional right. So that's kind of level one of the analysis. Now, before I get to level two, let me put a level 1A in there for you just for a moment. And that is, simply because it's constitutional doesn't mean it's necessarily going to comply with whatever statutes apply. So, for example, you couldn't have a repayment of training costs requirement that would result in the employee making less than the minimum wage, or you'd have an FLSA violation. You might have a state wage and hour law that would have some impact on one of these requirements. So when I say it's constitutional, I'm choosing my words very carefully there. It may not comply with whatever statutes apply, so you have to check that. Okay, but that's just 1A. Now let's get to 2. There's many things that are constitutional that in a collective bargaining environment, an employer cannot do without negotiating with a union. Simply because something's constitutional doesn't mean it's not negotiable. If, in fact, it affects wages, hours of work, and terms and conditions of employment, and you're in a collective bargaining environment, the employer is probably going to have to negotiate about that before it makes any changes in the area. And there have been many states, Washington, Oregon, Michigan, those are the first three that I can think of off the top of my head, where you have decisions from labor boards and courts saying repayment of training costs requirement are mandatory for collective bargaining. Why are they mandatory for bargaining? Because they impact wages, right? If they take effect, they end up reducing the amount of compensation that an employee gets. They don't affect really hours of work, but they sure do affect terms and conditions of employment, right? They affect the circumstances under which you can depart your employment. That's a term and condition of employment. So without regard to whether these clauses are otherwise legal, if they are unilaterally implemented or unilaterally changed, you may have a bargaining violation. So if you've got one of these things floating around out there, or you're an employer and you're thinking about imposing it, think about the fact that you've got to collectively bargain over the issue if you are in a bargaining environment. While we're talking about California, let me talk to you about a huge Bill of Rights case that comes to us from the California Supreme Court. This involves the California Firefighters Procedural Bill of Rights. There's a law enforcement police officer Bill of Rights in California as well. The Firefighter Bill of Rights is largely patterned after the Police Officer Bill of Rights and looks a lot like bills of rights from various places around the country. What this litigation concerns, and it comes out of the Orange County Fire Authority, what it concerns is a provision in the Bill of Rights that gives firefighters the right to review and respond to any negative comment that is, and I'm going to quote here because this is in the statute and it's important, that is entered in his or her personnel file or any other file used for any personnel purposes by his or her employer. Okay, so you got that? There's a right to read and respond to negative comments, either put in a personnel file or put into a file used for any personnel purposes by his or her employer. Okay, so what's going on in this case? It concerns a firefighter by the name of Steve Poole, who is supervised by a captain by the name of Brett Culp. And Captain Culp maintains what he calls a daily log regarding each of the employees that he supervises. And he creates this log both using a computer and handwritten notes. And what he does is he keeps separate files on all of his employees. He stores these files on a flash drive and also in hard copy. And that file is kept in his desk. What does he do with it? When he completes his annual performance evaluations, he'll pull out these files and he'll note on the performance evaluation anything that he thinks might be relevant, negative or positive, that comes from the files. And then he'll sit down and discuss with the employee the information that he puts into the performance review. And this goes on over several years. And eventually, firefighter Poole realizes that this is going on, and in particular, there are a number of negative comments that Culp is making about Poole, and eventually, Poole says, look, when you put things in your daily log, Captain, I want to see them, and I want to have the opportunity to respond to them. The fire authority goes, of course, up the chain of command in the fire authority, and the fire authority ends up saying, no, you can't see these things because they're not personnel files. They don't fall within the provisions of the Bill of Rights. And that case eventually makes it all the way up to the California Supreme Court. Now, the California Supreme Court hasn't decided many of these police officer or firefighter Bill of Rights cases. So this is a pretty important day when the court gets to decide one of these cases. And as you can imagine, by the time the case got all the way up there, there were all sorts of friend of the court briefs, amicus curiae briefs, that were filed on both sides of the issue as to whether or not these sort of daily log files were subject to the provisions of the Bill of Rights. And the court ends up saying, unanimously, no, they are not. The court is saying, it goes through kind of a lengthy analysis of what was said by different legislators when the Bill of Rights made it through the legislature. And the court ends up saying, look, the big deal here, the reason that the Bill of Rights was even addressing these issues of personnel files or files used for personnel purposes by the employer focuses in on the word used. The file has to be used by the employer. And that's not the case with this sort of daily log. Now, let me read to you the key paragraph in the court's opinion, and you'll see exactly where the court is coming from. The court says, a supervisor's log that is used solely to help its creator remember past events does not fall within the scope of the definition of personnel file. Even if a supervisor uses his or her notes to help draft performance evaluations and other documents that ultimately are placed in a personnel file, the notes themselves are not a file preserved by the employer for use in making decisions about the firefighter's employment status. Culp was not Poole's employer. Poole doesn't contend that Culp himself had the authority to take adverse disciplinary action. Only the fire authority could do that. Culp's comments thus could adversely affect Poole only if and when they were placed in a personnel file or in some other form to which the employer, that is, those who had the authority to discipline Poole, had access. So in other words, what's key here is whether the decision makers with respect to not just disciplinary decisions, but also potentially assignment decisions, particularly assignments that might bring with them premium pay, is whether those decision makers used a particular file. And because there's no evidence in this case that Culp made his log available to anybody else, the court says this is not a personnel file and Poole doesn't have the right to access and a right to rebut what is in Culp's daily logs. I'm not sure that's a terribly unexpected decision, but I do think one thing we can anticipate is that the fire union and police union lobbies in Sacramento will probably be back before the legislature trying to expand the definition of what a personnel file is. We have another Bill of Rights case that just came out, and this one comes out of Texas. Texas has what you might think of as kind of a baby Bill of Rights. It's not nearly of the level of complexity, or it doesn't cover nearly as many topics as, for example, the California or Rhode Island or Maryland Bills of Rights. But it does have some modest provisions giving employees rights in the disciplinary process. Now, mind you, in Texas, those rights are not substantive. They are merely procedural. They don't restrict an employer's ability to discipline an individual. They simply say, if you're going to discipline somebody, you've got to follow these procedures. Okay, and What's going on in this case? This is a case that involves a deputy sheriff. His name is Mark Staff, Deputy Staff, who works for the Colorado County Sheriff's Department in Texas. And the department opens up an investigation of Staff when the county attorney contacted the sheriff's department and provided a video recording of a traffic stop that Staff had conducted. And the county attorney is saying to the sheriff's department, I think that what Staff did during this stop was inappropriate. The county attorney never wrote or signed a complaint regarding his concerns over Staff's behavior. And in fact, the only documentation that Staff ever got about this is he received what the sheriff's department calls a performance deficiency notice. This was signed by a lieutenant. The lieutenant described Sparks's contact, described the county attorney's contact with the sheriff's office, and described an investigation that apparently had happened without much notice, if any, to Staff, and concluded with this little bomb: effective immediately, your employment with the Colorado County Sheriff's Department is terminated, and your services are no longer needed. Staff then sues the sheriff, and the sheriff's name, by the way, is Curly Weed. I think it's Weed, W-I-E-D. I apologize to the sheriff if I'm mispronouncing that, but it's a much better name if it's Curly Weed. He sues the sheriff, and what he says is these Texas statutes that form what I've referred to as a mini Bill of Rights require that complaints against peace officers be in writing and be signed by the person making the complaint, and that a copy of those complaints be given to the officer. Staff says, none of those things happened to me. What is the sheriff's answer? The sheriff's answer is, you are an at-will employee. Got no labor organization, got no collective bargaining agreement. You're not subject to any disciplinary standards whatsoever. You're at will. I can fire you for any reason or no reason at all. And therefore, the Texas Bill of Rights does not apply to you. And that's the issue that goes to the Texas Court of Appeals. Whether or not these disciplinary procedures, you got to give an employee notice and give them a copy of the complaint, whether or not these disciplinary procedures apply to at-will employees. And the court answers that question, yes. The court says the state or the county itself can implement procedures for resolving complaints and grievances, and it can do all that without altering the employee's at-will status. And now here's the exact words of the courts. The disciplinary statutes do not limit the authority of the sheriff to discharge an employee. Instead, they merely require that when a complaint of misconduct forms the basis for a decision to terminate, the employee must receive a signed written copy of the complaint before discipline can be imposed. Thus, says the court, the fact that an employee may be an at-will employee doesn't preclude application of these disciplinary procedure statutes. There's an interesting footnote in the case. It's kind of an interesting one. And that is that the sheriff has a backup argument, you know, in all of these cases that we see decided by the courts. And you always have arguments and then secondary and tertiary and whatever you go on after tertiary arguments that are being made. And in this case, the sheriff had one, and the sheriff said, look, that performance deficiency notice that the lieutenant sent on, that was just simply a recommendation. That wasn't the ultimate disciplinary decision. And the court rejects that and says, look, you know, when you hand an employee a document that says that you are terminated effective immediately, that sounds like a disciplinary decision to us. I want to end this month's podcast by talking about a case concerning firefighter staffing, and in fact, kind of staffing in general. And the question in this case, and it comes to us from Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court, is when is staffing negotiable? And the first thing I want to do is just give you a little bit of background about the negotiability of staffing. Remember I said earlier that if something concerns wages, hours, or terms and conditions of employment, it's likely to be negotiable. Well, one of the conditions of employment that is very likely to make something negotiable is if that condition impacts safety. I mean, it's for that reason that you see all sorts of clauses in a collective bargaining agreement concerning vehicles and when they get rotated. And there's even a case involving air conditioning and police vehicles. And there are other cases involving safety equipment like vests or ammunition. That's why all of those sorts of clauses, that's why they're negotiable, is because they impact safety. And you can pretty much bet that if a working condition has some sort of demonstrable impact on safety, it'll be negotiable, with one exception, and that is staffing. I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind that there is a relationship between staffing and safety. But what the courts have said is that not all staffing issues are negotiable. On the police side, courts, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think any court has ever held that a minimum staffing requirement in a police department is negotiable. Courts say that's just simply a management right. That concerns the level of service that this governmental body, this employer, is going to provide, and that sort of fundamental, or to use the words of the California Supreme Court, organic decision, that sort of decision cannot be subject to the collective bargaining process. That's on the law enforcement side. On the firefighter side, you see courts drawing a line very similar to the line that is drawn in this Pennsylvania case. So let's turn to the Pennsylvania case. I'm just going to tease you with where that line is until I can get some of the facts of this case out. This is a case that involves the city of Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Local 302 of the IAFF. They had a collective bargaining agreement that was set to expire in 2011, and that contract required that the city have 140 sworn firefighters and have an on-duty shift strength of no less than 28 firefighters. Well, when that contract expired, the city and Local 302 began bargaining. They were unable to reach a negotiated agreement. It goes to arbitration. They have a three-person panel arbitration typically in Pennsylvania over these things. The arbitration panel issues an award, and then it kind of goes back to the parties, and then it goes back to the panel. And the panel ends up deciding that among other things, the provision that the city have a set number of firefighters, this 140 sworn personnel, that should be eliminated, and that the 28-person on-duty shift strength staffing requirement should be reduced to 25. Okay, so the firefighters in the department, that goes away, says the arbitration panel, and on-duty staffing goes down from 28 to 25. The city isn't satisfied and seeks to vacate the arbitration award to the extent that it imposed the 25-person minimum staffing level per shift. And that's the issue that winds up before Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court, which is what Pennsylvania calls its Court of Appeals. And the court says this type of staffing is a management right. The court says look, we've dealt with this issue many times. Courts in other states have dealt with this issue many times, and we have drawn a very fine line. And what is that line? The number of persons on the force is not negotiable. Where the number of persons on duty at a station at any one time, or assigned to a particular piece of equipment, or deployed to a fire, those are negotiable because they're rationally related to the safety of firefighters. The court says this fine line that we see where staffing in general, number of firefighters that are employed, staffing per shift, where those aren't negotiable, and yet when you get down to a more granular level, the level of firefighter or number of firefighters per piece of equipment, that line between those, we find merit in that distinction. Why? Here's what the court says. The result still leaves in the municipality the ultimate decision concerning what level of fire protection it wishes or can afford to provide to its citizens. And the court says, look, you just can't make those sorts of things subject to negotiations and ultimately to arbitration. The court says the employer retains the authority to decide whether to hire more employees, close stations, revamp the force, and take other managerial action. And that is a decision that should rest with the employer alone. Now, what in particular is troublesome about the number of firefighters per shift? The court says the arbitrator's award, I'm quoting, unduly infringes directly on the city's managerial prerogative by restricting the ultimate decision concerning what level of fire protection the city wishes. Such a requirement is not as directly related to the firefighter's performance of its duties and thus is not mandatory for bargaining. And I'll tell you, that is a line that you see courts draw across the country. I have to be a little careful here because there's not unanimity on this issue of the negotiability of staffing. It does vary a little bit from state to state. But what I would expect to see, absent anything else, absent knowing anything about a particular state, I would expect to see a ruling that staffing in a police department is not negotiable, but that staffing in a fire department is, if it is described as the number of firefighters per rig or the number of firefighters assigned to answer particular calls. Otherwise, staffing in a fire department would also be non-negotiable. I do want to close with just a little bit of a war story on this issue of staffing. I was once bargaining a police contract in a state where it was predictable that there would be a holding from the labor board that staffing was not a mandatory subject to bargaining. And yet my client, the labor organization, very much wanted to have two-person cars at certain times and in certain locations within the jurisdiction. So how do you get around that when you're making a negotiations proposal? How do you structure things so that what otherwise would not seem to be a mandatory subject to bargaining actually would be subject to bargaining? What we did was we just simply phrased it as premium pay. We made a proposal that said that if there were less than two officers assigned to a police car during certain hours in certain places, then the officer who was assigned to the car would receive premium pay of 10%. And guess what? It didn't eventually make it into the contract. We were, I think, mostly firing one for effect there. But we did end up with a decision from the labor board that that wasn't a staffing proposal. That was a compensation proposal, not a staffing proposal. Well, that's it for this month, folks. Hope to see you upcoming in Las Vegas in November. We're doing a new seminar on advanced disciplinary procedures and standards. It's going to be an exciting seminar. We've got a whole bunch of speakers lined up to talk to you. And in the meantime, stay safe, and I will see you again next month for First Thursday. This is Will Aitchison signing off.